You're listening to This Way Up, a podcast from the Business and Human Rights Resource Center. We are a global NGO with research experts in 23 different countries, pushing for greater human rights accountability in business. In our podcasts, we will outline and interrogate the latest issues related to business and human rights, bringing together diverse expertise from frontline activists, civil society, companies, investors, and academia. In this series, we are partnering with the UN Working Group on Business and Human Rights to mark the 10th anniversary of the UN Guiding Principles and look forward to what the next decade might hold. Over the course of four episodes, we will examine the impact and reach of the UNGPs since they were introduced through a different thematic lens each week. We'll explore the impact, gaps, and opportunities as we look forward to the next 10 years.
Welcome to our podcast on responsible investing as part of a series marking the 10th anniversary of the UN Guiding Principles on Business and Human Rights, or the UNGPs. My name is Kristen Dobson. I will be your host for this episode, and I'm a senior program manager and researcher with the Business and Human Rights Resource Center. In this episode, we'll explore various aspects of the role of responsible investors in relation to the UNGPs, including what is their responsibility? When we say investors, who are we even referring to? Have the UNGPs been a positive force for investor responsibility for human rights? And what have been their limitations? And so much more. I am delighted to be joined by three guests, Michelle Cook, Stephen Heim, and Anita Durrett. Welcome, Michelle, Stephen, and Anita, and thank you so much for joining us today to share your expertise. I want to turn it over to each of you to introduce yourselves, and let's start with Michelle.
Yat e she Michelle Cook initiate hanagatni nishlint bilagana basis chin to bahi dashich e bilagana dashanali. My name is Michelle Cook. I am born of the One Who Walks Around You clan of the Diné Nation, and this is how I identify myself as a Diné woman. I'm also the founder of Divest Invest Protect.
Thank you, Michelle. Anita, let's come to you.
I'm Anita Durrett, Director of the Investor Alliance for Human Rights. The Investor Alliance is a collaborative platform for investors to come together to look at responsible investing centered on the protection and the promotion of the fundamental rights of people. Thanks.
Thank you, Anita. And Stephen.
Hi, everyone. My name is Stephen Heim, and I'm with Boston Common Asset Management, and I'm a managing director and also director of environmental, social, and governance research. We are a sustainable investment ESG-oriented investor, and also we are an active member of the Investor Alliance for Human Rights.
Thank you, Stephen, and welcome to all of you. It's great for our listeners to be able to learn a little bit more about each of you. We're going to start this episode with the basics, a bit of a 101 about the UNGPs and investors. Anita, what are the UN Guiding Principles on Business and Human Rights, and why are they significant?
Well, thanks so much for that question, Kristen, and thanks for having all of us on this podcast. The UN Guiding Principles on Business and Human Rights is the authoritative global framework for addressing business impacts on human rights. It was unanimously endorsed by member states of the UN Human Rights Council in 2011, and represents a watershed moment in establishing international consensus on the respective roles of state and corporate actors in ensuring business respect for fundamental human rights. The guiding principles rest on three pillars. First, the state's duty to protect against human rights abuse by third parties, including business enterprises. Second, the corporate responsibility to respect human rights, that is to actively avoid infringing on the human rights of others and to address adverse human rights impacts in which they are involved in. And thirdly, to access effective remedy by victims of business-related human rights abuses. In addressing the second pillar, corporate responsibility to respect human rights, which is what we're going to focus on today, the UNGPs sets out a human rights due diligence framework for businesses to use to address human rights risks in their business operations and their business relationships. The UNGPs applies to all businesses, including financial businesses, like the business of investments, and like us today, the investment activities of institutional investors. And that was in fact clarified by the Office of the High Commissioner of Human Rights. And in 2017, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, published a dedicated guidance for institutional investors on what responsible conduct means in the context of investment activities.
Thank you, Anita, for that grounding in the UNGPs, which is going to be really helpful as we move through our conversation today. Can you also give us a bit of a 101 about investors? Can you walk us through the different types of investors? And when we're talking about investors' responsibilities under the UNGPs, who are we referring to?
Well, you know, in the context of institutional investors, which is what the UNGPs is focused on, that is, you know, the business of investment, institutional investors, I would say, fall broadly into two categories, asset owners and asset managers. Asset owners are public and private pension funds. This is where we put funds, where we put our monies into or contribute to as part of, you know, our salaries at the end of the month. And this becomes a big fund, a pension fund, and are seen as asset owners. There are also foundations and endowments like university endowment funds. And there are socially responsible investors such as faith-based and value-based groups that look at investing the monies that they collect through their organizations and from their employees as part of pension funds as well, you know, as part of their investments. Then you're talking about the asset managers. These are organizations that have, or enterprises that have developed investment products where asset owners put in their monies. So whether this is in the public financial markets or the private marketplace, so the you can look at investments in two ways. Asset managers usually consist of financial institutions like banks and insurance companies, and they usually include investment managers and advisors that, you know, provide really that sort of insight to asset owners on where they should put their monies in. I also wanted to call out what I said before, that where you can invest in different markets. So when we're talking about public markets, we are really speaking to investing in public listed companies where we put our money into shares or equities in companies, or also potentially in the public bond market where bond notes are issued by companies or as well countries like sovereign bonds. And so you're investing your monies into sort of loan facilities that countries and companies can use. And where there is also a private investment market, this is where you're not talking about shares that are listed on the stock exchange, but it's where investments are made into private companies or private projects. Examples of this often include things like startup companies. Example in the tech space where smaller tech firms are needing funding to really explore innovation or come up with new sorts of technology products and services that might be used broader in the industry.
And Anita, you mentioned earlier the OECD guidance for institutional investors. Can you say a little bit more about what investors' responsibilities are under the UNGPs?
So when we speak to human rights responsibilities under the UN Guiding Principles or the OECD guidelines, we're referring to internationally recognized human rights laws and conventions. At a minimum, the International Bill of Human Rights, which consists of the UN Declaration for Human Rights and the accompanying conventions or covenants, International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, which covers rights to fair work, just working conditions, adequate standard of living, for example, and the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, rights to privacy, free expression, rights to non-discrimination. Together with that, we look at the ILO conventions, which encompasses rights to freedom of association, collective bargaining, freedom from forced labor and other sort of labor rights and workers' rights. So when we are looking at human rights, or what is referred to in the UN Guiding Principles as salient risk, you are looking at risk to people as a result of business activities. This is different from looking at material risk, which is looking at risk to business. In this context, we're looking at risk from really two different lenses. And these risks are often overlapping, as where there is severe risk to people, then there is also risk to business, risk to financial, legal, and reputational performance of a company. And as described in the UNGPs, there are three distinct ways in which a business enterprise, including an investor, may be involved with an adverse human rights impact. They could have caused the adverse human rights impact through their actions or omissions. They could be contributing to those adverse impacts either alongside other entities, such as clients or customers, or they can be directly linked to an adverse human rights impact through investments in their portfolio companies, which is more in the terms of what investments look like or investors' responsibility looks like.
Thank you, Anita. Stephen, you work for Boston Common Asset Management, which is a global investor in public equity that serves endowments, foundations, pension funds, and other groups across the United States and internationally. Can you share more with us about how Boston Common takes action to fulfill its responsibility to respect human rights? What does that look like for you in practice?
First, we are a global investor, so we invest in both U.S. Equities in non-U.S. companies. Actually, majority of our assets are in international stocks. So we look at all companies in all markets using the same human rights guideline, which is to not invest in companies that significantly and directly support human rights abuses. We've had that guideline since we started in 2003. And as the investor understanding has developed over the years, and we've also refined our approach, but we've had that as one of our fundamental investment guidelines for all the companies that we invest in. And we also, so the companies we invest in and also ones we don't invest in through large coalitions or initiatives and industries, we urge them to uphold the respect for human rights and look at human rights risks and impacts. But we also ask them to use their leverage as companies in their supply chains or as financial institutions to address the problems. And we urge that of other investors. And in practice, we've helped improve the practices of several companies that we've invested in. A couple examples I'll talk about more later are Apple and ConocoPhillips. We've also avoided investing in companies also. And finally, as an investor, we don't just look at the companies we invest in. We try to work with other investors, such as working with those in the Investor Alliance for Human Rights, or the Interfaith Center on Corporate Responsibility, or the PRI, Principles for Responsible Investing. And so we urge corporations and how they can report on human rights using the UN Guiding Principles reporting framework, and also to uphold international standards and to report more to their investors and to the larger stakeholders, just how are they approaching human rights? What are their challenges? What are they finding or issues? Are they doing due diligence on what they're doing? And just to be honest and straightforward in what they're doing.
And you mentioned a few positive examples of company engagement. Could you share more about some of the challenges you faced with influencing companies to respect human rights? And any additional information you could share about international human rights standards or frameworks that have been most useful in those engagements?
Yes, one thing we're finding, but it's becoming less of a challenge, is just companies aren't doing the due diligence that they should be doing on new markets they're introducing, new countries, or even new technologies that they're developing to examine how they may be contributing to human rights abuses. Companies also may deny responsibility or unwilling to walk away from lucrative business deals or long, intricate supply chains that may involve child labor or forced labor, for example, or other human rights abuses. Or that they are one company in a larger industry. So industry action is needed to address supply chain challenges. For example, not sourcing conflict minerals or cobalt, for example, that uses child labor. And a big challenge for investors generally is the lack of sufficient data and relevant metrics, what companies are reporting and the information and how they analyze what they're doing. An increasing concern that we're seeing, too, is the use of technology, artificial intelligence, and algorithms that can be used to harm human rights. We expect that investors need to have a better understanding of human rights and technology or digital human rights. This is especially regarding content targeting, content moderation, and freedom of speech. The key international frameworks that we've used among several are the ILO Core Labor Standards, which have been fundamental that we've asked many companies to adopt in their own practices and also for their vendors or suppliers. Next is the OECD guidelines for multinational corporations. And two that we've been very active on and supporting over the years is the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples and ILO 169. In 2010, we led investors that wrote to the United States government, urging the U.S. government to endorse the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. And I'm happy to say they did do that. It was the last country to do that in the world in 2010. And years ago, we worked with other investors as a couple examples to advocate that Apple include the ILO labor standard of respect for right to collective bargaining in its vendor standards, besides freedom of association. At the time, the Electronic Industry Code of Conduct was actually silent on the right to collective bargaining, but I insisted that they include that if they were going to do the ILO core labor standards. So Apple did do that, and later they were proud that they had that as part of their global human rights policies. Another example is with our engagement with ConocoPhillips, the oil and gas company, on Indigenous peoples' rights. Originally started with about their operations in Ecuador and Peru, but for 5 years, we encouraged them to improve their standards and practices, and one was including a reference to the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples in its Human Rights Position Statement, which the company did in 2011. And that's one of the things I'm most proud of our work on.
Thank you, Stephen. Michelle, several years ago, you founded Divest, Invest, Protect. Can you share more with us about this initiative and the impetus for starting it?
Yes, the impetus for starting Divest, Invest, Protect is to ask for global intervention in the financial industry on behalf of Indigenous peoples, Indigenous human rights defenders, and Nahatsan, our Mother Earth, to protect Indigenous peoples' rights and really to protect the last pieces of biodiversity left on this planet from extraction for the profit of very few elites. Our work is one of removing the cloak from companies, banks, and financial institutions and exposing the obscured and hidden predatory roles they play in modern resource colonization around the world. In terms of demographics, there are an estimated 370 million Indigenous peoples in the world, about 6% of the total world population, but we represent 90% of the world's cultural diversity. Indigenous peoples hold 20% of Earth's landmass, land that harbors 80% of the world's remaining biodiversity. For Native American reservations, while reservations just cover 2% of the United States, they contain about a fifth of the nation's oil and gas reserves, along with coal. So Indigenous peoples are holding down the earth. They are holding up the sky. They are carrying the responsibility of stewardship for the world, and they are being attacked for that. It's estimated right now that there are 5,000 distinct Indigenous societies on Earth, and yet each one is facing this historic colonial advance of a highly accelerated drive by global corporations seeking access to land and resources. According to a 2020 report from Frontline Defender, the urgent issues facing Indigenous human rights defenders continue today. At least 331 human rights defenders promoting social, environment, racial, and gender justice in 25 countries were murdered in 2020, with scores more beaten, detained, and criminalized because of their work. And it is these harms that are all too often funded and facilitated through banks and financial institutions through their acts or their omissions. And Global Witness, they've noted that investors, including development banks, are fueling the violence by financing abusive projects and sectors and failing to support Indigenous human rights activists. The statistics are horrifying. Indigenous women and peoples acutely suffer needlessly from reprisals and violence, making up nearly one-third of the total 331 defenders killed worldwide. And even though Indigenous peoples make up only 6% of the population, moreover, a significant number of those murdered were working to stop extractive industry projects. 13% of all those recorded kills were women, including six transgender human rights defenders that were killed in 2020, all of them in the Americas. So Indigenous peoples are at the point of the spear. Their well-being and their cultural survival has an impact on all life on this planet. We have to divest from systemic colonial legacies of resource extraction to invest in the future so that we can protect life and land and our global survival into and beyond the 22nd century. Can we, the peoples, be the intercession to stop the money before the contamination, before the human rights abuses begin? Before Indigenous peoples and their allies are maimed or arrested or detained and abused by law enforcement or security, private security actors hired by the corporations and extractive industries. We want a paradigmatic shift in finance that recognizes Indigenous peoples and their values, their contributions in shaping and forming the economic visions of a sustainable and regenerative future. On a practical note, we want legal and fiscal regimes of nation states and non-state actors to obey the baseline standards of the UN guiding principles on human rights, on the OECD guidelines, the baseline principles of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. On a practical note, we want businesses to respect human rights throughout the supply chain within all of their business relationships by taking steps of due diligence.
Thank you, Michelle. One aspect of Divest, Invest, Protect's work is co-organizing Indigenous women's divestment delegations with Women's Earth and Climate Action Network, where Indigenous women leaders meet face-to-face with investors and others to show how investment in fossil fuels violate human rights, Indigenous rights, and drive climate disruption. Can you share more about these delegations and an example of past engagement with investors?
Yes, Divest, Invest, Protect has organized 7 delegations of Indigenous leaders to meet with representatives in Canada, Europe, and the United States to expose injustices and directly share with these entities and the public, the press, and governmental representatives exactly how their fossil fuel investments violate Indigenous people's human rights while also driving climate disruption. Our program has engaged dozens of national and international banks and financial institutions, and we've trained over 20 Indigenous peoples in business and human rights. And the engagements have ranged from being positive experience to some being very hostile. Each one is different. Each institution has its own culture and its own norms. And some are more comfortable than others with women and with people of color. Some are more versed and competent in having challenging but civil discussions on how the UNGPs, for example, are achieved in the context of the provision of both project-level finance and corporate-level finance to companies with whom they do business. I liken the good engagements to an intellectual and moral fencing match between parties. And some of those parties have been better sports than others.
And Stephen, you've engaged with investors who invested in the Dakota Access Pipeline Consortium or its lenders about the human rights abuses associated with that project. Can you share a little bit more with us about that investor engagement and if the UNGPs were a useful tool?
Yes, that started in 2016, actually, in August 2016, when the father of the chairman of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe called a group of investors, the Investors Indigenous Peoples Working Group, where I was the chair of the Advocates Committee, and said, this is what's happening here at the Standing Rock Reservation. We need your help. And the First Peoples Worldwide, they had reached out to them to get connected to investors. So that's how we first started. And the UNGPs actually, in some ways, illuminate the shortcomings of governments protecting Indigenous people's rights in the U.S. Federal and state agencies, in my opinion, should not have allowed the pipeline to run about a mile from the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe Reservation under their primary drinking water, especially without their consent. So Boston Common first started in working with other investors on educating ourselves on what the issues were. We did a webinar for Wall Street investors in the energy industry and different companies. And then we recruited investors who would engage some of the oil and gas companies that are in the DAPL consortium, even though Boston Common didn't hold shares in them. And then following shareholder proposals and dialogue with investors, some of the DAPL companies expanded their policies on human rights and on joint ventures such as the Dakota Access Pipeline. But what came next was that working with the Investors and Indigenous Peoples Working Group is that we helped lead engagement with the 17 banks that financed the Dakota Access Pipeline. This was in consultation with the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe. 13 of the banks were signatories to the Equator Principles that really should not have allowed them to finance this project. But loopholes in the Equator Principles did not have them apply to finance projects in Canada and the United States, assuming that the national legislation would protect Indigenous peoples. And that's why I've said that what needed to happen was that the Equator Principles needed to apply north of the equator. And so we asked the banks to push for relocating the pipeline. However, they commissioned a study by Foley Hoag on human rights and pipeline projects. I want to note that two banks did drop their participation in the Dakota Access Pipeline Project Finance Consortium. Also, other banks in the spring of 2017 encouraged the Equator Principles Association to update their guidelines related to Indigenous peoples and free, prior, and informed consent. That later led to the Equator Principles Association moving to revise their guidelines, including on besides Indigenous peoples and climate change, and adopted new Equator Principles in November 2019. But regret to say that they were still weak in how they could have been regarding Indigenous peoples.
Thank you, Stephen, for sharing that experience. And Michelle, in your engagement with banks and other investors, have you found the UNGPs to be a useful tool or a positive force in pushing investors to respect human rights?
The UNGPs, or the RUGI principles, have been incredibly useful in that it provides a common language that can be used by businesses and various stakeholders in identifying responsibility and arriving at solutions to mitigate and prevent conflicts and adverse impacts to community and planet. In particular, the calculations of due diligence that analyzes how a company can be directly linked, contributing to, or causing a human rights violation, and what's necessary on the part of businesses to avoid that contribution, to mitigate through their leverage to prevent those human rights abuses from occurring. However, it is not the only source of law or legitimate authority that should be used in interpreting responsibility. Indigenous peoples, our voices and visions should also be seen, centered, and recognized as a unique source of jurisgenesis and generation of economic, international law and policy, both historically and currently.
Thank you, Michelle. And Anita, in where you're situated with the Investor Alliance for Human Rights, you have the opportunity to engage with a number of different types of investors. What do you see as the opportunities in using the UNGPs to drive investor respect for human rights?
No, thanks for that question. In a sense, Michelle sort of provided a little bit of that answer in the sense that it provides that common language. It is now an international framework that all global actors, all different stakeholders, be it businesses, be it communities, be it investors, can use in order to engage and speak to each other. However, you know, translating the UNGPs into how you use it in practice can be quite challenging. And investors have been trying to figure that piece out. And we've been working with investors, different type of investors, from faith-based investors who've been doing this work for 50 years and socially responsible investors, to more mainstream investors that have just started to take a look at the S in ESG as the human right angle to this. And so what the Investor Alliance did was pull together an investor toolkit on human rights, which really breaks down the UNGPs into what I see as digestible building blocks in trying to translate and operationalize the steps within the human rights due diligence process into how investors can really embed that into their processes and operations, both at an institutional level and at an investment level. It's really bringing those international frameworks, those international obligations as part of your DNA in your approach to doing business with integrity. We've worked with different sorts of investors. Some of them have really tried to embed them by creating human rights policies that really reflect how they want their investment activities, from investment decision-making to stewardship, and in some cases, even making decisions to really divest from companies, to really be the common policy that everyone follows within the firm. and not just ESG analysts or engagement specialists, but from portfolio managers to CEOs of the companies. And those decisions shouldn't just bind their investment decisions, but really how they make their own decisions on a day-to-day basis on their business operations.
Thank you, Anita. You've all, during this conversation, surfaced some positive aspects of the UNGPs and the contribution they've made to work on ensuring that companies respect human rights. But I also want to spend a little bit of time on the limitations of them. And Michelle, with that, I want to come to you. What have you seen as the limitations in using the UNGPs to drive investor respect for human rights? And what else do you think needs to change to ensure that investors really live up to their responsibility?
I think overall, there is a lack of enforcement and a lack of mandatory due diligence by companies, and this really needs to change. There is a lack of uniformity in the application of the UNGPs between nation states and non-state actors. Some nation states are domesticating human rights within their legal regimes, the standards of due diligence into law. And some banks have created human rights policies and grievance mechanisms that are internal to their businesses. But the challenge also exists because indigenous rights are often not upheld in their respective nation states. So when states like the United States do not recognize the right of free, prior, and informed consent, how can international business partners then adhere to and comply with their human rights policies and standard when the nation itself denies that right? So there's this lack of alignment between the UNGPs and domestic legal regimes with which indigenous peoples interface. And even worse, in some states in the U.S., there is a complete dismantling of ESG. For example, recently in Texas, there was a bill approved that would require state pension funds to divest from financial companies that boycott energy companies. This would force the state's retirement systems and pension funds, which manage well over $200 billion in assets, to divest from any company that refuses to invest in fossil fuels. So for as much as we have gained and advanced business and human rights, big oil has taken notice. They have seen how ESG is able to stem the tide, and some businesses are working to prevent that change.
Michelle, you've also really brought us back to the first pillar of the UNGPs, which is the state duty to protect. You know, a lot of our conversation has focused a bit more on the corporate responsibility to respect, but it's absolutely part of the UNGPs that the state has a duty to protect human rights. Stephen, coming to you, looking at the next 10 years, how do you think the UNGPs can be most effectively leveraged to ensure that investors live up to this responsibility?
Well, one key area is looking at the whole production and marketing supply chain of companies from design all the way to the end user. Another area I'd say is, besides for fossil fuel industry and extractives, impacts on human rights. Another related sort of extractive is on renewable energy. I want to note the Business and Human Rights Resource Center guide on renewable energy and human rights benchmark to drive better practices by companies, where a lot of the human rights defenders are also for renewable energy projects where they've been suffering, whether it be hydro or wind power projects or others. But it's really important for investors to do their own human rights due diligence on their holdings and prospective companies. Unfortunately, the ESG data providers have a long way to go in providing the information that investors need. I'm pleased that the Business and Human Rights Resource Center is working with a consortium of different groups to advance what types of data and information is needed for human rights environmental defenders. Another area is for urging their own portfolio companies to implement human rights due diligence practices, including for existing operations or for new countries that they're looking to go into. Another useful reporting framework that companies can use is the UNGP reporting framework that SHIFT helped develop. It has a simple set of questions for companies, and our experience is that companies have actually found it help on their internal practices to reveal things that they really didn't know, and also when they are ready to actually publicly disclose that information. That it's very helpful on the internal side. And this is something that company investors can encourage companies. I mentioned the Equator Principles earlier. It was good for the improvements that the banks made, but for investors need to push banks to look at it as a baseline for banks to do more, to do their own due diligence, their own risk assessment, and look at the key areas also of mitigation, grievance procedures, particularly for project finance that they might be involved in. That needs to be part of the whole package. And then finally, as Michelle mentioned, of the threats to human rights defenders globally, including here in America. So investors, whenever possible, support human rights defenders in the communities that they live in.
And as one of our last questions, I want to come around to each of you to share your thoughts on this question. Can you share one effective tactic or a key lesson learned in your work to ensure that investors respect human rights? And Michelle, first want to come to you.
The methodology of using personal narratives and face-to-face engagement between Indigenous peoples and businesses. It's much easier for companies to ignore human rights abuses when those abuses are far away in a distant land. It's not easy to dismiss or to deny the existence of and impacts on Indigenous peoples when they are sitting right in front of you and speaking right to you. We really want to open up the floodgate to open up the door for Indigenous peoples all over the world seeking justice and peace through humane investments, to encourage that participation and to encourage their journey for justice and peace in their communities.
Stephen, how about for you?
Well, one key lesson that we found was the importance of bringing the community voice to the table. That was one of the things that we insisted in our dialogue with ConocoPhillips over many years, was we had Amazon Watch participate right in the meetings with investors in our dialogue on the company's operations in Ecuador and more particularly in Peru. So that was very helpful for our discussions. Basically, they were sort of our expert to provide feedback, but also challenge what the company was saying. But we think also that through having agreements on using of Chatham House rule for the discussions, which Amazon Watch respected, led to a building of trust and understanding over a number of years with the company, which advanced the company, I think, in many ways. But that also gets to my point of investors doing their own investigation to challenge what company assertions are that they are respecting human rights. We really have to do our own due diligence, talk to communities, talk to different groups, and be part of investor coalitions to try to advance these efforts. We really have to not go by what the company says or what the ESG data providers say, but do our own due diligence and take responsibility for doing that.
And Anita, in your experience, what has been one effective tactic or a key lesson learned?
You know, Kristen, I mean, what both Stephen and Michelle shared is really the key tactic that we've seen in really driving investors to take that responsibility to respect human rights. Investors, as Stephen said, have been talking to a lot of business organizations, to data providers, to companies. They haven't been speaking to the communities that are impacted. And what the Investor Alliance has helped to do, really, and it's one of the key premises of the UN Guiding Principles, is ensuring stakeholder engagement. And so that's the key tactic, which is, I guess, an obvious one, but hasn't been done that much. Investors are really far away from where the impacts are actually happening. And so having that sort of stakeholder engagement through the work with human rights defenders, where we have, you know, collaborated with the Business Human Rights Resource Center, Boston Common, the Forest Peoples Program, really helps to bring those issues to investors and be, for them to be able to advocate on it. And the second piece, which I'm going to add, is in terms of engaging with stakeholders, one of the stakeholders is the state. And so really talking to policy and standard setting bodies, really engaging with policymakers and standard setting bodies who have that duty to protect, and really bringing the investor voice to say that we want the state, want these policy setting bodies to really create a responsible environment for responsible business. And they can do that through regulation. And so, you know, really closing that gap between domestic laws and international laws and supporting the international framework that the UNGPs is built on.
Thank you, Anita, Michelle, and Stephen. This has been such an illuminating conversation. We're really grateful to you all for sharing your insights and experience with us and everyone listening. It's clear from what you've shared that, yes, the UNGPs have made a positive contribution. They've provided a common language, that there is increasing knowledge among investors about their responsibilities to respect human rights, and there are progressive investors engaging with companies on their human rights responsibilities, that there are a number of investors that are further along in this journey. And at the same time, we still face many challenges. There's a lack of enforcement, a lack of mandatory human rights due diligence, a gap in information when it comes to ESG data providers. And as you just highlighted, that investors are often not directly connected with communities that are harmed by business projects and human rights defenders facing real risks. And ultimately, we are talking about the people that are at the forefront of protecting our rights and shared planet are at risk and experiencing real harm. And that is something that we have also been conducting research on at the Business and Human Rights Resource Center and have found that since 2015, there have been more than 3,100 attacks against people speaking out about negative impacts of business operations, so that there is a real need for further action and for regulation by the state. Want to close on a note of hope. Would love to hear from each of you one thing that is really giving you hope as you continue this work. Anita, I'll come to you first.
I think it's really hopeful that we've seen businesses come together, and we've seen real progress in businesses recognizing that they shouldn't put human cost above profitability. And they're looking at really sort of long-term sustainable development, both on an economic and a social and political levels. So we're seeing really all different stakeholders recognizing that we need to protect people and planet for the future.
Stephen, what is it that is bringing you hope?
Well, I'm really hopeful that there seems to be a greater understanding and commitment by investors of human rights issues and generally, and their responsibility to respect and protect human rights, including impacted communities and human rights defenders. We've seen that large public pension funds allied with committed ESG investors and faith-based investors can make a huge difference. A couple of examples are with Dakota Access Pipeline and the Equator Principles, how both CalPERS, New York State Pension Fund, and New York City Pension Fund all joined Boston Common and many other investors in the engagement with the banks and also the Equator Principles Association. And then with an example I mentioned earlier with ConocoPhillips, working with the Church of the Brethren and many other ICCR members and also the New York State Pension Fund, that all led to a series of important progress by ConocoPhillips on Indigenous people's rights. So I do think that by allied together in coalitions, leveraging one investor, working with many investors, I think we can make a huge difference.
Michelle, what is one thing that gives you hope as you continue this work?
A wise man once said that practices crystallize into norms and norms crystallize into rights. The more that we engage, the more we can shape and develop the norms and expectations in the realization of Indigenous people's human rights by businesses and financial institutions. The more we engage, the closer we get to developing rights for Indigenous peoples that will be enforceable, that are in alignment with international norms and standards. And each chiseled step that we take gets us closer to justice and accountability. And so I think that that gives me hope. And I'm confident in our victory that we will be able to prepare ourselves for the 22nd century in a sustainable and regenerative way.
So thank you again, Michelle, Anita, and Stephen, for everything you've shared during this conversation and for closing us on that note of hope. Also want to thank our listeners for being in this podcast with us. We hope that the expertise shared is useful for your work, and we look forward to engaging with you further on this topic.
Thank you for listening to This Way Up from the Business and Human Rights Resource Center. We hope you enjoyed the episode. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on Twitter at BHRRC and let us know what you think. Please keep tuning in, and if you like what you hear, share on your networks.